So when I was a teenager, I was interested in spirituality, and I grew up in a sort of Christian culture, obviously, and I became interested in the mystical side of it. And then when I was about 16, I drifted away from that, from the Christian context, because it didn't seem to be kind of giving me what I was looking for. And I started reading about other religions. This was in the 60s, and got interested in enlightenment and all of that stuff. And so when I was 17, I went to the London Buddhist Society summer school with my brother. And that was in the south. We were living in the north. We were from the north of England. And there I met Douglas Harding completely by chance. I didn't know of him at all. And he showed me who I really was. You know, he did the experiments. He got us to point and that kind of thing. And that was what I was looking for. So it made a big impression on me. And I, you know, it didn't, it wasn't something that I was not thinking about. I was thinking about it, but it was really lucky for me that I came across him. And so it was later that year that I went and visited him at his house with my brother and my mother. And really, that was the beginning of a long friendship and involvement in his work and supporting him and continuing to do that now.
And what did your brother and your mother find?
My brother got into it as much as I did. He's still the same. And my mother, she was impressed, and she took it on board, although my father was not interested. And I think that it's quite hard to keep the awareness going if you don't have the support around you of a community of friends who are also practicing it. You get distracted. You forget about it. It's not on the front burner. So, whenever I talked to my mother about it, she was quite, she was clear about it. But I didn't see her that much, I suppose. And so I think that just shows how important it is to have a support system around you. Not essential, but that's what I did. When I got to know Douglas, he always said, come and visit to anyone who was interested as a friend. And he was an architect and he built a second house. And we used to use that second house. It wasn't a very big place, but that was where we all met. You could go any weekend and there'd be always someone there, or even in the week. And so right from being a teenager, I made friends that I am still friends with many years later. And we all had the seeing in common, and it was non-hierarchical because anyone can see their true nature. And it was very supportive and a learning experience for all of us, working out what we'd found and how to live from it, really. And I was particularly interested in sharing it. Most people are not, and it was just my personal interest. I thought to myself, this is an amazing breakthrough in terms of communicating your true nature without having to join a club or follow a leader or believe in anything. You just look and you pay attention and you're your own authority. So I just thought, wow, this is fantastic. And what an opportunity to use these experiments and share the seeing. And Douglas was 24/7 all about seeing who you really are and sharing it. So I took that on board, and the way it developed was the one that took up the flame, really. And we set up a charity. I set up a charity 25 years ago. And we've got a website and a YouTube, you know, and one of my goals was to make all of Douglas's books available for, you know, to buy on Amazon in the end. And that's been quite a big job, but we've got a lot of good support, people volunteering to help, and we've done a huge amount of it. So that was one of the goals, and just to make the experiments available.
Yeah. I think that's a great and kind of rare thing to find such a strong purpose in a practice. So then you sort of have that meaning from a practice that you believe in, plus the community around it. A lot of these, a lot of the mindfulness and meditation can feel a little bit solitary. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about the session with you was how fun it is and how much joy people get and almost always start laughing when they do it.
Oh yeah, it's very different from a solitary meditation practice with your eyes closed usually. You retreat into a quiet place. This is the opposite. This is out there in Piccadilly Circus. This is noticing your face to no face with others. This is noticing that you are space for the world, not retreating, but seeing you're empty for the world is engagement. And because you get it right from the beginning and you can't not get it. And there's no advancement in the nothing. There's advancement in understanding. But the main thing is seeing that your space, and you can't get any better at that. You just have to enjoy it. And this means that there isn't this kind of program that you daily following and hoping to get along a bit further, and are they doing it better than me, and shall I go on a retreat to deep, all of that goes out the window in a way, because you've got it and it's simple and available. You've got to live it, but living it is, becomes more of a sort of enjoyment than a task,
What do you think, because you've introduced so many people to the practice for the first time, what's the biggest obstacle to people seeing it?
Well, there isn't any obstacle to seeing it. You can't see your head. So
I guess maybe it's the people seeing the value or not seeing the value of it.
That's it, yeah. And everyone is different, and I can't predict who will value it and who won't. And it's not really my business. I will share it, but I just get on with it myself. But I suppose I haven't really thought of it like that, but the biggest obstacle would be if someone just wasn't interested.
Right.
But that is that, in my view, is completely valid. I don't have a problem with that. I think that's amazing that you wouldn't be interested in it. That's almost more interesting than someone who goes, wow, someone who says no, of course, you could say there's lots of other reasons, but I usually only share it if I'm invited to. In a workshop, I've been invited, so I don't have the brakes on. But normally, I wouldn't just talk to someone about it. That would be unusual unless it was called for. And if someone does ask about it, and I usually share the experience straight away, because what's the point of talking about it if you can have the experience and then talk from the experience? So I say, well, notice you can't see your head. Instead, you see, my face. We're face to no face. You're looking out of an open space. And if I notice that they're not interested, I just back off. There's no point. So I respect people's reactions in that way.
Can you talk a little bit about your work as a therapist then, and what you've learned from that, and any connections you've drawn between that and the headless practice?
Yes.
I guess, when did you decide to become a...
Yes. Well, I met Douglas Harding in 1970. Mm. And then around about 1977 or 8, I just took a step back in a way, not from the experience, but I just needed to... I was very, very involved. Helping with all the projects, all the workshops, and I needed just to step back to have some space for myself personally. And at the same time, I got interested in Buddhist meditation. Okay. And I went on a retreat, and I found it rather good because it just gave me time to be quiet and still. And I went to live at the meditation center. It was in England. And they asked me to train after a few months to lead retreats. And I was there 4 years. And I led 10-day retreats, one after the other. And it was a fantastic experience. Now, I was in a good position because I was already seeing who I was. So basically, meditation for me was just enjoying being the space for the world. But I could see that others were rather confused because they were trying to get to it through sitting. And yeah. I don't know how you do that. I mean, it is just total good luck if you somehow do. And you usually people have the experience and then don't know how to get back to it and spend the rest of their time mm-hmm. trying to get back to it. And I was in a bit of a difficult position because I was leading Vipassana retreats. So I would introduce the headless way, but it wasn't a headless way thing. So anyway, it was a really valuable time to just to be still and quiet and with the seeing. But when that finished, I didn't know what to do. I'd gone there. I didn't have a job, and I thought, well, what you want to do in your life, Richard, which is share the headless way, but you don't really have the opportunity to do that because Douglas Harding is doing anyone who wanted a workshop would contact Douglas Harding, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have a problem with that, but there was nothing for me to do in a way, in much of a way. And I thought, well, in a way, how can I prepare myself for when there is time for me, you know, an opportunity for me? And a friend, I came back to London after this 4 years at this meditation center in the Fens, and I met a friend who was training in psychotherapy. And at the meditation center, someone had looked at my books on my bookshelf and seen they were all about meditation, and she said, "You don't have anything on therapy." And I thought, therapy? And when I got to London and met this friend who was training, I thought, that's what you need to do to find out what that world is all about. Because if you understand it, that'll help you because you can speak that language. You can help you communicate about your true nature. So I just signed up with the same course that she was doing in North London. And it was a 3-year training. I did it, and at the end, and it was good, but it wasn't about the headless way. It was, mm-hmm. You know, it was about therapy, and but at the end of it, I realized, oh well, you've got a qualification here, because I mean, I went to Cambridge, but I studied history. I wasn't going to teach history, and so I started practicing, and. Then got into running groups. I'd run lots of groups now at the meditation center, so I had a lot of experience. And I ran a therapy group for 15 years, one therapy group. Every week I ran that group, and I was running another at the same time. It was all private. But anyway, over the years, I worked out my relationship, just as I'd worked out my relationship with meditation. from the point of view of seeing, I worked out my relationship with therapy, which was that, quite practical really, people generally have not come for the headless way. They've come because they're bereaved or they're ill or they're angry. They've not come for seeing who you are. So it's not my job. I'm not being invited, but it is where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. So when the person walks in the room, I am face to no face with them. I'm space for them. Their voice is my own. I understand that they're living from the openness like I am, but they don't know it. But that means that I can empathize more deeply because I kind of place myself where they are. One of the main conditions for good therapy is trust. If you haven't got the person's trust, nothing will happen. And when you are seeing who you are, it's basically a welcoming position because you're built open. So you don't have to say anything. That is a sort of welcoming, friendly attitude in a way, if you want to put it like that. Of course, I also, Douglas Harding did work on where seeing who you really are fits in terms of personal development. So the baby, the child, the adult, and the seer is his map. But I thought a lot about that and kind of worked out my own way of thinking about it under his umbrella. But, you know, you have to work these things out for yourself. So, you know, in terms of theories of personal development, I've got a good understanding of how, you know, where headlessness fits in, as it were. Yeah.
It must have been difficult not to be tempted to use the headless way as a tool for therapy. I mean, obviously it made you a better therapist, but to encourage people to be less conscious of themselves.
Yes. I believe that in the future it will be. Hmm. But just as at the beginning when someone like Jung came along with his ideas after Freud about the unconscious, to begin with, that was not part of normal therapy as much as there was therapy, but it's become standard. So, and things like TA or, you know, those things, it takes time. And it'd be very odd if the headless way didn't become used, because it's so effective and true. But it's just way ahead of its time in a way. And I just had to respect that my clients were not interested or hadn't come for that. And I couldn't, especially when I was working for an EAP, Employment Assistance Program, you just get 6 sessions, which I love. I became very good at it. But you haven't been invited to share the headless way. It would sound as if, you know, if I started sharing the headless way in a therapy session, from the outside, it would be like someone say, well, I think we need to get on our knees and pray to Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, it would be like that therapist's thing. So however appropriate it is deep down, it's not appropriate as in that way. So anyway, I didn't mind. I was quite happy just to, you know, because people are living from it, even though they don't know it. Everyone's living from this. So you can sort of talk in their language about it without having to talk about headlessness, you know. Yeah.
Do you ever feel like you're doing therapy when you're teaching the headless way?
Of course, yeah. If therapy is healing, yes. This is this is profound healing, isn't it? I mean, the basic split healing is bringing, you know, split parts together, if you like. Healing a wound. The basic wound is between the self and the world, or the self and other. And when you see who you are, you see you're built open, you're space for the world. There's no dividing line. That is healing.
Yeah. I certainly fall that way. I like that visual as well. That makes a lot of sense. Let me think. So have there been any big challenges for you in terms of promoting the Headless Way or working with people? Has it mainly been just...
Well, I think you learn as you go along, and I learned a lot from Douglas Harding. And he learned a lot as he went along. He first saw that he was headless in 1943, and he didn't share it until 1964. That is 21 years on his own, thinking that he would never share it. And I think that was, he drew the meaning out of that. He didn't complain. That was what was given. But when he started to share it, he began to realize how infectious it is. In other words, it's a social thing. And he, because he'd built this second house, he then had a place where people could come, because his wife wasn't interested in it. So he couldn't really comfortably invite them to their main house. But this house meant that people could meet. And I believe he saw how powerful it was to be with others, how inspiring, how it is a demonstration that everyone's got it, that you can't not get it, that it's non-hierarchical. But everyone responds differently. And the nature of the experience is it's social, face to no face. That is social. You know, that's not you sitting on your own, becoming enlightened on your own. That is you with others, seeing that their face is yours, and you know, they have yours. You know, trade faces. And he also was very keen on encouraging people to, if you went to a workshop with Douglas, usually he would ask you to lead an experiment.
Okay.
Now he would do that partly so that people in the audience, as it were, could see it wasn't just Douglas who'd got it, but also he, I think, recognized that when you start to share it and use your voice and express it and communicate it, you learn.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they say, if you want to learn, teach. You know, if you want to learn, communicate. And so part of, I have taken on board those ideas that it is really, you see, when you grow up and you get your head on, this is the developmental bit, the way you get your head on is everyone gives you it. Everyone tells you, you know, that's you in the mirror, that we can see you. You don't think it up yourself. You get it from everyone around you. You've no idea what you look like until people start to tell you and show you, the mirror. So it's a social thing, and it's 24/7. As you're growing up, you don't have any respite, relief from that. It's 24/7. You are what you look like. So you take it on, and you do it back. You know, you as you're growing up, you learn to identify others, you see. And if you then want to get into being aware of who you really are all the time, well, hang out with others, because if they're doing it, you're going to get it and you're going to give it, right? It's the same mechanism. It's not some obscure, esoteric, strange, mystical thing that lands on you. It is completely common sense. You know, you get your head on through society, and society helps you get your head off, you know, God willing.
Yeah.
That's why I've set up the Zoom meetings. We have 7 or 8 Zoom meetings a week. Today we had one. Wednesday we had one. We had 30 people, 25, 26 people. And that is more or less averaging out now. And with the coronavirus thing where people are stuck at home, I think it's going up. Mm. But anyway, those groups have been running for 10 years. And so what happens is that people make friendships.
Right. They become actual other communities.
Yeah. That is based on seeing who you are. It's what we've got in common. And really, you see, when you grow up and get your head on, you learn a language that supports that idea. I means Richard. You know, I'm going down the road. I as an object are going down the road. And when you wake up to who you are, what is happening is that a language is developing to articulate this. I am face to no face with you. I'm still in the room, the street moves through me. I haven't got a single eye. I'm empty for the world. I am you. All this is a language that articulates the first person singular point of view, as opposed to the third person. So it's not either or, it's both. And when people meet, and what happens is that in a meeting where we're meeting because we all are valuing who we really are, we are developing, learning to communicate about it. And once you get a language going, it is really a kind of settling in and deepening into the society. So this is a long-term project, but certainly with the internet, it means that people can meet very easily, whereas in the past, you'd have to physically go, you know, to a location. So it's all moving forwards.
Have you noticed a growing interest in, I know just generally there seems to be more media attention, or at least around mindfulness, self-awareness, well-being. Have you experienced a surge of interest in Headless Way?
Oh, yeah. No, it's growing all the time, but it has little spikes. For example, the conversation that I had with Sam Harris, that spike. Our website is normally about 9,000 unique visitors a week. And just in the week, couple of weeks or 3 weeks after that conversation went out, it went up to probably 15,000-20,000. Wow. Now it's back down to 9, right?
Sure.
But generally it's getting known. And the thing is that it is very infectious because it's so easy to get. You don't really have to understand much. You look for your head and you can't see your head. Instead, you see the world. You're looking out of a single eye. I'm speaking. My voice is coming out of nowhere. This is the way it is. You know, it's not trying to change anything. It's just being aware of who you really are privately and valuing it. And the power of being with friends is that you get infected by other people who value it in their way. And you think, wow, that's true. Or, yeah, no, I get that. Or, God, I hadn't thought of that. Or, you know, we've all got the experience. But so it's like anything like this. You know, the way this has happened is it's taken a long time, I suppose. Mm. In terms of our lives, I've been with it all my life, but we always knew. Douglas Harding was so well read and so deep thinker, and you know, knew history. He could see, you know, he understood that these things
take time.
Mm. Yeah, they're not an overnight mushroom kind of thing. They're from the grassroots up, but that's very strong, you see. And it is strong because people are not reliant on an authority outside themselves, a teacher or a book or an organization. So they're very, once you get it, that there's no hierarchy, no leader, you become very protective of that because it is so unusual. And the thing about the Zoom groups that often people say is, what is really special about these groups is it's non-hierarchical. I'll be there, but I'm not there as someone who knows something that others don't in a fundamental way. You know, I have experience, but everyone, you know, I'm a beginner in that sense. I'm there to learn and to, you know, because we haven't been here before in terms of really having a community. Well, there was a community of seers around Douglas. I mean, he started something from himself. And he traveled a lot, and he was always very friendly and very inviting and very encouraging. You've got it, you know, you've got it, you've got it. You don't have to come back, but if you want to, come back as a friend. And people loved that, and they loved him for that. And so he made many friends around the world, and I'm still in touch with a lot of them, yeah.
It does seem to me that people are quite hungry for meaning and as well as a sense of community, because it can, I guess just the nature of technology and some people's work, you can feel quite isolated. So I think that's why this practice is attractive. Have you noticed a difference in people who've come, like say when you started to now, and what they're looking for? Or do you just not talk about that stuff?
Well, I am interested in what people want, and I'll, in a workshop at the beginning, I'll ask people, and I want it to be a dialogue, not just me talking. But in a short workshop, I have to take that role, because otherwise we just have a chat. You know? So
yeah.
I need to lead and share the experiments. But in the Zoom groups, there's much more time. And people, you know, over the years, we get to know each other. And everyone is different. So, you know, I mean, what interests you?
Well, I was just wondering if like a more distracted lifestyle made it harder for people to see.
Because no, it doesn't. No,
no.
You can't see your head. What's difficult about that?
It's so simple. It's just ridiculous.
I know. Well, you see, there you go. You see, that's one reason why people might dismiss it, because it's so simple. It's ridiculous, but it is simple. It's ridiculously simple.
Yeah, I became interested because I felt like I had, as you said, with something like meditation, spent a long time trying to occasionally get a glimpse of this state where I felt like I was totally part of my surroundings. And
how often did you manage that?
Right. Maybe once. And sometimes you occasionally feel it when you're in a state of awe in nature or something. But then as soon as I did the headless exercise, it was so clear immediately, and it felt like I can access this at any time when I'm feeling weighed down by everything around me.
Yes.
And that people, if I am feeling uncomfortable with the people around me or closed in, it helps me feel like there's room enough for everyone.
Yes. Well put, you see.
Yeah. No, it's... And I just also found it interesting that you were so struck by it that you have really made it your mission to share that. I think it's just a great thing to do.
I was already sort of committed to that before I even met Douglas.
Okay.
I was already somehow committed to the mystery.
Right.
I'd somehow heard it. Yeah. When I was about nine.
That's so unusual. Yeah.
Yeah. I suddenly tasted the mystery, and I thought that interests me far more than any particular thing, that mystery of where we came from and where we're going, you know, the great mystery. So from that moment, I said to Sam Harris in the conversation, it was when I was about nine, I was at boarding school in Yorkshire, and the headmaster was a Christian. He was a religious man, but he was very open-minded. He wasn't dogmatic, and there was a deep love in him, and it was experiential. You know, there were others who were just saying the words, but he wasn't. And he gave a sermon one evening, and I told this, you probably remember it from the conversation.
Yeah.
He told a story that the Venerable Bede told. The Venerable Bede was, I don't know, 9th century up in Northumbria. And he told this story where the local lord was having a big feast. It was winter, and there was a big fire, and all his, you know, kind of people were there in the hall. And in through a window, an open window, flew a sparrow, flew across through the light and out another window, out from the dark into the dark. And the Venerable Bede said, you know, that is a metaphor for our lives. Mm. And I thought, where did that sparrow come from? Whoa. And where did it go? That, it wasn't what was happening in the hall that really grabbed my attention. It was, where did that, you know, so that fired my interest. And that really is, you know, where the Headless Way fits in. It allowed me to, you've disappeared.
Yeah, sorry, I'm still here.
You've gone out the window.
Yeah. The internet was playing up a bit, so I'll just come in.
All right. The Headless.
So that sounds like quite, sorry.
You need to, there you are. Okay. So the Headless Way came along, you know, 8 years later for me. But enabled, you know, it Douglas was pointing at the same thing, but had a way, you know, had this fantastic breakthrough.
Yeah.
Which he'd only recently developed the experiments when I met him. And it was very exciting. And he was excited and he was on fire because he'd found this way of sharing. And it was true. And he'd worked it out.
And found the community, I guess, to help him do it rather than feeling like he was alone.
Well, he started talking. The community began partly because he started teaching comparative religion to adult education locally. And he had done a huge amount. He'd written a book, Religions of the World, that was commissioned for schools. So, and the Headless Way was in that at the end as a scientific path.
Oh, okay.
And when he was doing these comparative religion classes to, you know, adult education, anyone interested in the Headless Way, he would say, come back and visit. So very slowly, gradually, a community of people who were interested, you know, he just talked to people and he shared it. And he was the kind of person who, you know, he said, come and visit. He was a great host, you know, he was very generous. So, yeah, so, and obviously he understood and as he went along the power of community, but it arose organically. It wasn't, as far as I understand, it wasn't a kind of program or
right plan. Yeah. As you said, yours isn't necessarily with the trust. Or do you have
a... Sorry?
With the trust, that sort of just developed over time.
Well, yeah. We tried to create a trust in the 70s, and it was not accepted by the Charity Commission.
Okay.
So then I tried in 1996, got refused, then talked to a friend who had the Ramana Maharshi charity, talked to the solicitor, it was given the solicitor who helped them get charitable status, and he helped me, you know, he managed it really.
Okay.
He knew the guy who'd said no to me at the Charity Commission. He had worked with him and went and talked to him and persuaded the guy to say yes. It was so lucky.
Yeah.
But it has been great, because to have a structure like that, that is not me personally, you know, it's not a business, it's a charity, just is the right way to go for us, you know.
Yeah. Can you tell me any stories of just some personal experiences that you've witnessed of people's journeys with headlessness?
Oh, well, I have a, you know,
I'm sure many.
I mean, it is so often, a bit like what you were saying, it is so often people will say that they've been meditating for years and got nowhere. And suddenly, headless way, got it, you know. And you get, you know, stories now, those people, they can read the scriptures and understand them. Whereas before, they were, you know, right, reading and trying to work it out.
Okay.
But when you've got the experience, it's crystal clear, really. Let me just say that it is one of the great pleasures of sharing the headless way, is that, I mean, like you, people's reactions are so dramatic and sudden, and a light goes on. I can't think of any other path where that happens, you know. Just sit for 10 years, you know. I mean, when you, again and again, and I get emails, you know, all the time of people saying, wow, wow. Now that is just, I mean, it's kind of normal for me now, but it's still fantastic. And you go to a workshop and people, you saw it, you know, people's lights go on. There's a guy called Steve, and I just put his little video he made on our YouTube channel. It's there now. And he came to the workshops at the Psychedelic Society, and he came all the way from Cheltenham.
Okay.
And he usually had to go back a bit early with his, you know, because it was such a journey. But he emailed me telling me he'd just made this little video of two experiments. And he said, you know, meeting you, my world has turned upside down and inside out in the best way possible. And of course, I know exactly what he means, you know. It literally, you're not in the world is in you.
Mm.
Now, all the time, it is just such a pleasure. And I think, you know, I sort of almost pity other spiritual teachers, you know.
They don't get the payoff quite as often, probably.
I talked to someone, fairly recently, who'd got in touch with a spiritual teacher, and asked, you know, he was suffering problems with self-consciousness, and asked advice from the spiritual teacher. And the spiritual teacher said, well, sit opposite a wall saying a koan. Well, he tried it for 2 weeks, and, you know, that was enough of that, you know. So you think, what are these people doing?
Yeah, I think it's certainly, I mean, I've known people who've done like the meditation centers and the silent retreats who have gotten something out of it, but it never feels quite as profound or obvious. Like it was an important experience for them, but maybe not in the revelation sense, more of a sense of self-discipline, or that right. They were really shaking themselves out of their daily routine, and it maybe gave them a new perspective, but it doesn't feel like I've found the key to transcendence. And that's kind of what
they were. Whereas the headless way, I mean, you know, it is like so direct.
I wonder how that translates into people's sense of self-identity and purpose.
Okay, so I think when you see who you are, you're home and dry, but it's the beginning of the rest of your life with it. And you've got to, just as when you get your head on, you've got a lot to work out to find out who you are as a person. You know, your name, your age, where you live, how to walk, how to talk, you know, how to, you know, operate at school. You know, it's a huge learning curve. And when you see who you are, you're home and dry, you've got it. But there's a learning curve as well, which one of the learning curves is, all right, I see who I am, but what about Richard, or, you know, what about Lauren? I mean, how does who I thought I was fit in with this awareness that I'm space for everything? And in my experience, you see, there is a kind of idea in spiritual circles that you've got to get rid of yourself or something like that, you know, or surrender or let go or disappear. I don't know, you know, the ego is a problem. And what I have found out is that having an ego is brilliant. There's nothing wrong with it at all. It does not, for a start, it does not get in the way of seeing your headlessness, because I'm seeing my head is out there. It's not here, you see. And anyway, you can't get rid of it. You can't. So, right. I mean, if you feel self-conscious or separate, does that stop you seeing the space? No.
No. But the ideal, I guess, is that you feel part of the space around you, which means that you're...
Yeah, but you won't 24/7.
Yeah. I know. No, this is the temptation, is I was so excited with headlessness, is you want to try it everywhere all the time.
Well, you can. You can. Yeah. But that's where the learning curve is. You realize that it doesn't produce the feeling of oneness all the time. Mm-mm. And you have to work out that the seeing is not a feeling.
Right? Okay.
You can see you've no head, but you might not feel one. And people think that when you see who you are, you feel one all the time. Mm. And you work out, you realize through experience, if you're being honest, that you don't. And that is life. And life is the view out is a continual seesaw between yes and no, up and down, feeling one, feeling separate. And it'll always be like that. But you're looking from this place that is not separate. Mm-hmm. So the space has, within the space, you feel all these different things. And that's part of the learning curve, that it doesn't solve all your problems and it doesn't make you feel one all the time. But you can still see who you are at will, anywhere, anytime, and that's the blessing of it. It's not dependent on how you feel.
I guess that is maybe something that you've learned over time. Is there anything that any sort of big lessons you've taken from the journey from when you were?
Well, that is a big one. That is a big one, because the feeling of being separate or self-conscious or anxious is not nice. And particularly, you know, like, I mean, the situation today, but it's something that, you know, one doesn't wish for and doesn't want. And I, in my life, had to come to terms with the fact, and I have to come to terms with it again and again, but I had this idea, hope, that I would lose my awkward self-consciousness or my feeling of separateness. And I thought, if I see who I am enough, you know, that it'll go. And it didn't, and it hasn't. And I now, you know, as understand, I don't, or, you know, I accept sometimes and I resist other times, but it, that's around, and that's being human, and that, that's your life. And one lives with that from this freedom. The freedom isn't, so that's a huge thing, because that means that I can admit to feeling down, you know, and I can admit to feeling self-conscious or a failure or frightened, you know, worried about the virus, and, you know, and that is to be expected. But my refuge, therefore, is not in somehow reaching a state where I'm never afraid, because that's not going to happen. It's actually bringing my attention here, where there is no fear. The fear is out there in the view. The anxiety is out there, and I'm free of that here. Everyone is, you see. It's not an achievement. And that's the meditation, two-way meditation, fear to no fear. Problem to no problem, person to no, and it is sort of life will teach you that you can't avoid the problems, you know, except here you're free of them, you see, and that's the meditation, is face to no face, problem to no face. And this is a great resource, of course, you know.
Because it's important to see the truth and not be blind to
exactly.
That stuff. So,
I know. So, someone who claims that they now have no fear and anxiety, I think, good for you. What on earth is that like? You know, I don't understand that. You know, what does that mean? No twinge of anxiety at all? You know, no, not even for your friends? You know, wow. That could be interpreted as very strange. But it's not my business. I don't care, really, you know. But, you know, the fact that this openness is so available all the time, whenever you look, not dependent on how you feel, not demanding you behave, you know, that you don't feel anxious. It's very kind. It accepts you just as you are.
Is there anything you're sort of worried about in terms of trends of our society that you think would be helped by the headless way?
Well, I think that seeing who you are is a remedy for all kinds of things. I mean, face to no face is a game changer. Right? When you're a baby, you are not face to face. You're just open, right? And growing up, you learn to imagine your face and being behind it. All right, you've got that going. That means you understand you're a person. But it's only half the story. It's the outside story. And the inside story is you're built open face to no face. And this is what all the great teachings have been about. Jesus, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, because your neighbor is yourself, right? You know, namaste is the one in me is the same as the one in you. So this is at the core, you could say it's love. Now, here is a way of introducing this, which is not asking people to be nice to each other, you know, to take on another moral code. It's saying just be honest and look and then see what happens. And that means it, you can test it. You look at my face now, it's face to no face. See, that's not saying now you've got to be nice. That's saying, what's the truth? Now see what happens from that. You know, live the truth. Don't don't just settle for half the truth, which is, you know, you're aware of what you look like. Settle for the whole truth, which is you're also aware of where you're looking from, which is built open for the other person, which is the other person. You know, Jesus had a huge effect. And I would say, because he was aware of this, and he translated it into relationship and said, love your neighbor, love. You know, so Christianity is about love, really. Well, that, you know, people resonate with that. That is meaningful. Well, the headless way is providing you with a way to that. Now, whenever you're with anyone else, be honest and don't lie and see that you're face to no face. See? And as I say, it doesn't mean that you have to change your behavior. You will change your behavior, but it's not now laying down another rule. It's saying no.
Sometimes I feel like people don't even know that they can't really put their finger on the source of sort of an unhappiness with their life, even if, you know, so they're going through the motions as they should be, and but they feel a lack of meaning or a lack of connection to something.
Yes.
And I'd be curious if, because I think you have to kind of want to see.
Yes.
If it would work as well on them or not.
Well, you see, I think for some people, they'll say yes straight away.
Yeah.
But other people won't really get it in terms of understanding it. But the more people who say yes to it, the more they carry everyone who isn't quite sure.
Sure.
Because people want to go along with the crowd.
Right. Okay. So that's why it's so important to build a movement. Yeah.
Well, yes. But the way that Douglas sort of showed me and the way that I have followed is not to try and build a movement, really.
Okay.
It is just to water the root and let it grow. Because the way it will grow organically and naturally will be much better than any planned way. So what you do is you just throw the seeds out all over the place and see what sprouts. Mm-hmm. And you know it is solid gold. What this is solid gold. It's not a business. You're not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. You're sharing, it's totally transparent in a way. And that is powerful. You know, as you can see, people get it. Now, you know, in a workshop, everyone, you know, it's huge kind of take up. The thing is, you know, I'm glad to have lived this long, because I've had as long as this to throw more seeds out. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And now with the internet and the more that it kind of strengthens from the ground up, and the more people share it with each other, you see. Mm. So it's got quite a strong grassroots network. And so it's as if we've been working under the radar for years.
Right.
Serving that. So I'm optimistic, because I can see that it's in good shape. And although it's not above the radar, really, and it's not very big numbers, that's not so important as the authenticity and the genuine connections between people but you know having said all that, one just lets go and enjoys it for oneself, right? You know,
right.
And then of course that transmits as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I just really think that our society could use something very positive like that, that is so accessible to everyone.
Well, yeah, that, I mean, exactly. We're trying to shout it from the rooftops.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing everything we can.
I think Sam Harris will hopefully help you out with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was very interested to cover it for that reason too.
We do believe we've got something incredibly important and fresh and non-traditional in terms of its method of sharing. It's very traditional, the message, but the method is a breakthrough, the experiment. And we're not ashamed of saying that, you know, here is something new. Mm-hmm. And effective and in line with modern science in the modern age in that way. And it, you know, you can understand it takes time for people to understand that and accept it. But yeah, we're doing our best.
Yeah. Do you think that... just wondering if you think that our society kind of values that self-development or honesty.
Well, I don't really think about that.
Yeah.
You see, if you've got a blackbird singing in the garden, it sings its song, right? It's not worried whether what the other birds are singing. So I think we're just singing our song. And I think, you see, I tend to think that, you know, if you've got a party going on in the on the block, and there are parties down the road, if your party is not very good, you'll go down to the other parties and tell them, come and to our party. Mm. But our party, the Seeing Headless Way party, is so good. We don't have to tell anyone. You know, the music is so good that we just enjoy ourselves and people start coming. You see what I mean? So we're not in the business of, you know, really, you know, we do our best to talk to people and to educate people. But we're having such a good time, you know, that we think, you know, you're kind of mad if you don't, you know, well, we just, we've got the best music.
Absolutely. I think it's great. I think that community aspect really makes all the difference. It really differentiates it. When I did the workshop and they set up the WhatsApp group, it's just...
But you should, if you're interested in that,
yeah,
drop into some of the Zoom meetings.
I will. Yeah, I just saw those on the website. So,
but I'll send you the information. Did you get the information about it?
No. Could you send?
No, I'll send you the. There's a private page on the website. I only give it to people if they've done the experiments.
Oh, okay.
And it's the information about all the Zoom groups, so you can drop into any of them and just hang out with people. If you're interested in you know, even just from your point of view of doing research,
yeah,
you could drop in and see how it works.
I'd love to hear what people are saying in those groups.
Yeah, sure. Exactly.
Yeah. And to talk about our headlessness in coronavirus.
Yes, all of that.
That would be perfect. Okay.
I'll send it to you after this, yes.
Yeah. Did you have anything else to add? No, I think that was really, really interesting. Obviously, it's had a huge impact on a lot of people, and I hope the Sam Harris app content goes well.
Yes.
You've submitted that now.
I have done.
Okay.
We will see. We will see.
We'll look out for your voice on there.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. Well,
a delight to talk to you, Lauren.
Yeah. And,
hope to see you in some of the Zoom meetings.
Yes. When's the next one? Sorry.
Oh, there's Friday, Saturday, two on Sunday, Wednesday. There was one today.
So oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So there's several each week.
Time
yeah.
for everyone.
Yeah, that's right.